Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Book Network podcast. I'm Deidre Tyler. Today, we'll be talking to Alving Ng, author of Our Laundry, Our Town, My Chinese American Life, From Flushing's to Downtown, Stage and Beyond. How are you doing today?
Oh, very well, thank you. Honored to be here. Thank you, Deidre.
Thank you. I wonder if you could begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in this project.
Sure. Yes, I'm a lifelong New Yorker. My parents were immigrants from southern China, from the Toisan village outside of Guangzhou. And back then, they were the first generation right after the first, and I would say, God help us, the last American law that made it illegal for one race of people to become citizens here. Of course, that was the Chinese Exclusion Act. So that really colored everything for us, where how my parents saw the world and, of course, how they taught me. But because I'm the youngest of five, for better or for worse, I had a lot of freedom. A lot of freedom to do different things, and that led me to even though where I grew up, the Flushing neighborhood of Queens, in the borough of Queens in New York City, in the 80s and 90s it became New York City's second Chinatown. But when I was growing up, we were one of the few Asian families there, so like everyone, I wanted to fit in, and I regret it now, but I refused to learn how to speak Chinese. I just wanted to fit in, but by the time I was getting ready to go to college, it was ironic that suddenly, for the first time in my life, everybody looked like me, but I couldn't communicate with anyone because they were all immigrant Chinese that spoke primarily Mandarin. And also, my family spoke Toisanese. It's a small dialect of Cantonese. Sometimes I say it's almost like Creole French or something. I learned a lot about assimilation and immigration in America in the late 20th century. I often joke that I worked so hard to fit in and by the time I got there, there was no there. So that led me to this book came a long way. Where I'm primarily a playwright and performer, and now I call myself an acoustic punk raconteur. I tell stories and play my songs. But I first started doing two autobiographical stage monologues, one-person shows. One was called The Flushing Cycle, and one was called The Last Emperor of Flushing. And so in doing those two, it really got me thinking about my own story. And I grew up loving music, particularly rock and roll. And I always made an analogy between playwrights and songwriters, where I felt like a songwriter and the play, the song, the play can always be reinterpreted in many different ways, all different styles, idioms, and everything, just like a play. So I guess after years of touring as a performer, I said I wanted to make a record, make a more permanent record of these stories. And also, while I love the theater, because it's literally common ground. We all have to sit in the same space, breathe the same air, and really share the same energy. I love the intimacy of a book. It's just one-to-one, mind-to-mind experience wherever you want to experience it and in your own time. So that led me to do this as a prose project. So that's a little roundabout way of saying how we got to here.
Now, you talked about growing up in the laundry. There were lots of things going on. Describe a busy day for us.
Sure. Well, it was there was always people coming in, and we had to wrap the clothes. But I think, again, because I'm the youngest of five, and it was quite a large span, because my sibling number one, my oldest brother, he's 15 years older than I am. So in some ways, we had like a two sets of families. The first three siblings were born in succession within 3 years, and then I was born later on. So by the time I grew up, actually, we were in some ways, the laundry was more of a middleman, if you will. Like, we were just taking the dirty laundry, taking the clothes. We would sort it according to the customer's codes. And then it would get wrapped up to get most of it to get washed outside. People would pick it up outside, and then we would wash some things inside the laundry. So it was a lot of sorting. And then when it came back, we'd do some ironing and packing up the packages. So there's a lot to do. And it really grew out of there's not many Chinese hand laundries left now, certainly not in New York City or around, but back in the early 20th century, before my parents got here, it was a primary source of labor for so many immigrant Chinese, because like a lot of the immigrants, they had to do literally the dirty work in this case, like the jobs that other people did not want to do. So that's what we took on there. And yes, it was the 70s and 60s, so it was still like the end of the Cold War. So sometimes we had to put up with a lot. People would open the laundry door and just sort of yell epithets and real slurs at us. So I learned a lot about that too, because, you know, only one of my parents spoke English. My father spoke English, so he was on the front line of laundry. He would be in the front room where the customers would come in, and a lot of the family business and my mother, they stood behind him. And so I learned a lot about the way of the world, of how my parents interacted with the customers and in turn the world. So the laundry was a very fascinating place.
Now, you brought back memories of the black and white TV shows. How did those shows influence your life?
Oh, well, first of all, back then, TV was and probably still is the best ESL, what they used to call ESL, English as a Second Language Teacher. I believe now it's EOL, English as Another Language, EAL. But so my immigrant parents, they had the TV, and I am named after the Alvin Chipmunk cartoon character. So that's how deep the TV ran for us too. Because the rumor has it that my previous sibling, his name is Herman, but he wasn't named after it would have been convenient to say he was named after Herman Munster, but he's named after the cartoon character Herman. And because the older siblings named him and not my parents, they let my brother Herman name me. And his favorite TV show was Alvin and the Chipmunks. I was saying, just grateful that his favorite shows weren't like Captain Kangaroo or Leave It to Beaver. So, you know, TV was a big influence. And then, yeah, so there was always that black and white TV on in the house. And then later on, TV became, you know, for so many young people, like it's for kids, it's your window onto the world. And even though he wasn't, I learned later that the TV series Kung Fu, even though he was played by David Carradine, I was so hungry for any representation, if you will, any role models that I so loved, that, oh my God, as a 7-year-old, the full issues and complexities of representation were not clear. Of course, I was 7 years old, but I was so excited that there was what I perceived to be a Chinese like hero on TV. I've since learned later on it was not, but that was a big turning point.
Now, Bruce Lee, martial arts and rock and roll. Tell us about that growing up.
Yes, it was everywhere. Bruce Lee just changed the entire cultural conversation, where suddenly he was this international star. But I guess in some ways, too, while he was great and this and that, he was too, I think he was a little bit much for me at 7 years old, because he was so strong and so combative. Where I was a very passive person. I still am a very passive person. So that sort of intimidated me. But I guess feeling like growing up as feeling like always an outsider, again, we were one of the few Asian families in our neighborhood. So I really felt like a total outsider. So of course, a lot of outsiders gravitated towards the arts and music. And in my case, it was a lot of rock and roll, in particular punk rock in the 1970s. And that was a place where, for the first time, I fit in. I found a community that said, okay, we're not going to hide our otherness anymore. We are here to shout about our otherness and celebrate it. And that was a very liberating thing, to find these communities through the arts and music. And then that also led to the burgeoning Asian American movement. Of course, that grew out of the civil rights movement. And by the time I got more involved, like after college in the 1980s, that was also another further deepening and acceptance of my identity and my viewpoint, really, really validated so many things. So getting involved in first the punk rock worlds and then the Asian American arts and activism worlds really helped ground me.
Chinese culture and fruit. Tell us about this.
Yes, it's always there. The fruit. Did you say food or fruit?
Fruit.
Fruit. Yeah, fruit. It's always there. Like, and of course, as a kid, the last thing you want to eat is fruit. But it was always prevalent. Like, we always almost like the peeling of the orange represents like a new day. It was always prevalent. There was always tangerines around, particularly around the New Year. There's all sorts of. It's always like a fruit feast going on. So fruit, and also I think my parents, they're primarily rice farmers. My parents and previous generations, we were all farmers. Like we were from the southern China, so they were all farmers. So it was such a big thing of us. Even my family could finally afford to have a house, a home that was separate from the laundry. And again, that's where I was lucky. The other siblings, they all grew up in the back of the laundry. I only spent my first few years in the laundry. But then after that, my family could afford to buy a separate home. And with that home, they also had a backyard. And in the backyard, they loved to grow fruit. They grew grapes. They grew all sorts of things. So fruit was always a big part of it.
Now, in Chapter 3, you talked about your father's mother and her illegal papal son. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, what it was is it was a common practice in the late 19th and through the mid 20th century, where a lot of Chinese immigration was based on being a paper son or paper daughter, paper husband. This was meaning you had purchased essentially illegal identification papers to come to this country. And this is also aided and abetted by in the early 20th century, I believe 1906, there was a huge fire in San Francisco, and with that, a lot of the records. Of course, this is way before digitalization of all public information. So all of a sudden, it became wide open that all these records were suddenly destroyed. So there was a lot of when we got back to China, people could use all these different identifications. So my father he came in and started working in Chinatown restaurants, New York's Chinatown, and then later on started a laundry through Chinatown Village Connections, Chinese Village Connections back in Toisan, China. And so that's how he came in. He came in under false pretenses. He since became a citizen. He was also a veteran, but he had to come in that way. And again, in order to circumvent the Chinese Exclusion Act as a young person. So he came in that way. And then after 65, after the Voting Rights Law and after the Civil Rights Act too, where they were really, for the first time, they were really encouraging immigrants to have a family reunification. So my family, led by my father, really tried to take advantage of that moment. He changed his paper name was the name of our laundry. Our laundry for all those years was Fu J Chin Chinese Hand Laundry, and his name was Fu J Chin. And he said, okay, at this point now, after 65, I'm going to change my name back to my ancestral Ang, so that way I have the same name as my mother to try to bring her in. And that worked, and something's ever changing. In researching the book, I talked to a lot of my family, cousins, and siblings, and they said that the key thing, in addition to all the paperwork and all the, let's say, above board applications, that they also had to make a contribution to a local politician's campaign that really sealed the deal.
Now, you talked about your mother being an arranged wife, and she didn't hear from your father for 10 years. Tell us about that.
Sure. No, it was I guess it was common at that time, too, because, again, my father came over first, and he started working in Chinese restaurants in New York City's Chinatown. And although he was so poor by American standards, by our Chinese village standards, he became a rich man. So he went back to China and really had his choice of an arranged marriage. An arranged marriage was made to my mother. And again, my mother was 14, my dad was 16. So it was a different world then. They had this arranged marriage. And then after the arranged marriage, after the arranged wedding, my father returned to New York City, and my mother did not see or hear from him for 10 years. And on stage, on the page, I was shocked that I think about this, a young boy, from a very small, poor farming village in China, was in New York City with more money in his pocket than he ever imagined he would ever have in his life. I will say, I can't imagine he was preparing the nest for my mother's arrival that whole time. But then, because my dad had his laundry, his essentially his seed money and his network through through village contacts, my mother was able to find out where he was, and she came over with a paper husband to pose, and she came in and found him and caught up with him. And then many years later, this is also in the book, I got to meet, well, I'd always met, they stayed friends, the person who was my mother's paper husband who helped her get in, even though she was already in an arranged marriage with my dad, again, she had not heard from him for 10 years. So she found a paper husband to bring her to America, and the family stayed in touch. And of course, as a child, all the stuff went completely over my head. I didn't know what was going on. But many years later, once I knew the whole picture, I got to see him again. And I was so thankful to him. I was so thankful he did all that. But I asked him, I said, it's fine if it was, but was your helping my mother come in, was it a financial arrangement? And he just said, no, I just wanted to help as many people as I could. And so it was very moving to that. So it was a very complicated thing, the paper son, paper husband thing. And it just grew out of, yes, arranged marriages. So it was very a very different world. And it still is amazing to me now. Like, we travel with all our GPSs, all things, but they were these young kids really crossing the mighty oceans, going to places where they didn't know the language, didn't know the culture. It's still, as I would say in the 70s, it still blows my mind.
The Chinese Bachelor Society, I thought that was interesting. Explain that.
Sure. That is a part and parcel of the Chinese Exclusion Act. I would say these were the walking wounded or the left behind, the men, because it was, they made it, it got so bad, like the ratio of Chinese men to Chinese women in most Chinatowns during the Chinese Exclusion Act it got as high as like 20-1. So people used to, you know, really call this is not Chinese Exclusion Act, this is the Chinese Extinction Act. And so they made it illegal for most Chinese men to bring over their wives or to marry American citizens. So as a result, you had this enormous Chinatown Bachelor Society, and that had a huge impact. There was all these men. Even by the time I grew up in Queens, which is about like 12 miles from New York City's Manhattan's Chinatown, and every Sunday, that was, again, our laundry was open 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. So Sunday was the only day off. So we would almost always drive to Manhattan's Chinatown, and I would see my dad hanging out with these guys. Somehow, you know, I always felt that was his natural habitat. And I felt like, unfortunately, my parents had a very contentious arranged marriage. And by the time I came along, the fifth of five, they were very tired. So they really, I had a lot of freedom for better and for worse. So, and he was very like lackluster around me a lot. But also when he would be with his Chinatown Bachelor Society cronies in Chinatown, he lit up. He was like a different person. And he would love hanging with them, like, you know, eating and drinking, playing cards. And then at night, we go see these Cantonese movies. And sadly, they're all gone now. These were these great old movie houses all throughout Chinatown. And I would notice in the audience, I was like, wow, there's a lot of men here by themselves. Again, as a kid, I had no idea why. But now looking back, they were the remnants of the Chinatown Bachelor Society. And that whole thing, again, because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, followed up by McCarthyism and all the attacks on Asians in general, but on the Chinese in particular, I used to think, why is it there? Why do my parents only socialize with other Chinatown people and only other Chinese hand laundry owners? But I think it came out of that was how they felt safe. They were, given all these circumstances, they had to live a under the radar existence. So I think that was imposed on them by these American laws and mores, and that became how our socialization was.
Now, in chapter 6, you talk about the disappearing axe and the red dress. Explain that to the audience.
Yes, my parents, unfortunately, they had a very contentious marriage. It often led to physical violence, fights with each other, and sometimes it would just get to a point where my mother just had to leave. It was and she would always put on a red dress. It was almost like red for the Chinese is a very empowering color. People always say it's almost like an amulet, if you will. Like it will help you, protect you. Like people even saying in the beginning of the year, certain people in your Chinese zodiac, if it's your year, sometimes it can be a rough year in the beginning, and they say to really help ward off evil spirits and just keep yourself together, try to always have something red on your person, either in clothing or or something in your pocket or your pocketbook. And so she always did that. It was like her, I guess her cloak of armor, feel. So she would disappear and go to some friends, I assume, and just disappear from the laundry for a few days. And as a little kid, this really, it really freaked me out, of course, because again, my father, he was there for me, in all the essential ways, but in all the tangible ways, but in all the intangible ways, he was not there. He was very absent. And then suddenly now, again, because I was the youngest of five, by this time, my next oldest brother, the siblings 1 through 3 were, by this point, were already married and out of the house. And my next sibling, number 4, Herman, he was a teenager, so he wasn't around much. So in addition to being freaked out that my mother was gone, it made me really spend a lot of time with my father. And that was not very comfortable. Just me and him, this big old laundry, again, in our big old 1970s Chrysler Newport car, and then in the home. It was very uncomfortable. And it just said a lot to me. And then we were just such an insular family, an insular lifestyle. It was so bizarre and powerful to see we would always enter the laundry through the back door. I thought that was very symbolic of our lives. And then, but then on the days when my mother would end her disappearing act, she would come in through the front door, and usually only primarily non-Chinese and customers would walk in through the front door. But to see my mother come in that front door was so alarming, but so comforting as well. Of course, it was alarming to see her come through the front door, but just, of course, so comforting to see her come home. And I learned a lot from that. And then when she decided finally she was not going to run away anymore, not pull any more of these, what I called, disappearing acts, she had her own little private ceremony. She took a garbage can behind the laundry and just burned that red dress. And I think a lot of times at Chinese memorial services and morning rituals, when you burn objects, you burn elements, that's another way to communicate with the people who are no longer on this mortal coil, on this human sphere. So I think it was her own private ceremony. She didn't tell anyone, and no one was – she didn't say it verbally, but you could tell her body language. She didn't want anyone to be part of it. She just did this herself. And when she was burning that, I'd love to know what was going through her mind. But, yes, that was a very intense episode. Yes.
Now, something that was really comforting to read, going to true life with your mother. Explain to the audience about that.
Sure. True Life Lutheran Church is the only Lutheran church in New York City's Chinatown. And it came about in different ways. Like this is all coincided in the early 70s was when a lot of things just started to, sort of really, really come apart in the family. So this is when my mother started her disappearing acts. Things were getting even worse between my parents. And so I felt on our own parallel journeys, we were looking to reach out. And at that time, being a young pop music fan in the early 70s, there was so much religious imagery and so much about salvation in pop songs. Like people were doing covers of that gospel song, Jesus Is Just All Right With Me. And of course, they had that humongous song by their former Beatle, George Harrison, My Sweet Lord. People sing songs like Presence of the Lord. So it was all over our pop culture. And I think, obviously, this is still, the waning days of Vietnam. I think people needed a spiritual and faithful connection. And I felt that through the music. I wasn't sure that. And I just felt this emptiness as our own home was being there. And obviously, my mother was going through so much with these disappearing acts. But yet it was my oldest brother, my brother Gene. He was very religious. And he got involved with the True Light Lutheran Church. And so we took his cue and started going there. They have services in both in Chinese and English, and they still do. If you come to New York, it's at the corner of Mulberry and Worth Streets. And so it's very common that we found this bond there, just to go to that. For me, it became a combination of just being young. I didn't want to spend Sundays all the time there. But yet my mother became a lifelong parishioner, if you will, of True Light Lutheran Church. And they were always took care of it. I think it gave her that sense of community and just that spiritual balance that she was clearly lacking in our home. So it was very, very grounding for her and for me for a while too, but my search just kept going on. But it was something we could share for a while. And also, they just tapped into other things where the other family business. But for my mother and myself, that's where that came from. In the early 70s, there was a real, I guess, sense of internal despair for so many of us that we needed something else.
Now, the story about your grandfather in Chinatown, do you think this made your father anti-drugs?
Oh, completely, completely. Like I never saw this, but I'd heard that my grandfather died of an opium overdose, and because my father had to essentially identify the body that my older siblings were much more conscious of that at the time, or they said he was never the same after that. And then even the smallest mention of any drug use or anything brought out enormous tirades from him, even sometimes sadly literal smackdowns. Like, he became so anti-drug. And then years later, this came about, it brought about a very interesting revelation for me. Like, as again, I felt like liberated through punk rock, but yet growing up in the 1970s and loving punk rock, like, we idolized what we called this heroin chic, if you will, the heroin, like, again, saying everyone wanted to be act as if they were a heroin chic junkie. No one wanted to be an actual user or an actual addict, of course, but everyone wanted to have as if they were this detached heroin chic figure. And I loved, like, the people, like, the poetry and music of, like, people like Lou Reed and, like, Patti Smith and people like that. And then I was worshiping this punk rock world and finding for the first time a community. But yet there was the chapter is called Chinese Rocks also. And when I, even just hearing about the song Chinese Rocks, it freaked me out. I thought, oh my God, I guess I felt like in my young teenage ways, I thought maybe through punk rock, I could actually forget that I was different, forget that I was a Chinese American. But just seeing that song on an album cover, not even hearing the song, put the issue right back in my face, and I had to deal with it. And many years later, I learned about the impact of opium through the opium wars and just in opium use in China and its enormous indelible impact on the Chinese diaspora and on Chinese immigration, of course. And just a side note, I'm working on a new piece now, what I call an acoustic punk rock and tour piece called Here Comes Johnny Yen Again, or How I Kick Punk. And it juxtaposes these two things, like growing up idolizing heroin chic junkie and that whole thing, and then learning about the enormous impact, how opium just changed China through the opium wars and then opium usage. So yes, it opened up many different things. And I never met my grandfather, but I still, every year, the Chinese call Hong San, like walking the mountain. We always honor the ancestors by bringing flowers to the graves. And I always think about that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All world rituals. After your father passed away, what were some of the roles that your mother had to play?
Well, the whole thing changed because, of course, I was not part of the decision-making process. I was just a kid. But when my father died, I was only 14. But it was decided that we were not going to try to carry on the laundry. The laundry was sold. And then it totally changed our dynamic because I was essentially what they used to call growing up in the 70s when I did. I was essentially a latchkey kid my whole time. When I wasn't at the laundry, I'd go home by myself. But my parents were always working in the laundry. So all of a sudden, it became different. In some ways, though, just the fact that you don't have to work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, that's a very different thing. But she had to take on a lot. But also my older brother Herman did too. And in some ways, the family structure was very hard on him, I think, because he grew up, let's say, the first 5 years of his life as the youngest of the family. So he was doted on. He was spoiled, like as the youngest usually is. But then I came along and things changed. And then soon siblings 1 through 3 were out of the house, and he became like the man of the family, especially after my dad died. He was only 19 at that time. At that time, you still have a lot of wild oats, so to speak. So he stepped up a lot too to help my mother. And all of a sudden, just the dynamics changed. Even being a teenager, you realize we now have a single widowed mother. It's a very different world. So this came about very differently for all of us. It changed all of our dynamics. And again, just our concept of what a family means and what a family does.
1987, going to China. Tell us about this.
Yes, it was enormous. Like I finally made peace with being an outsider, and just things opened up where I just said we have to go to China. And I guess I think a lot of people in their mid 20s, it's the first time, unless you're in graduate school, the first time the mind unwinds a little bit after living such a structured life for so many years, of course, going through your schooling and then maybe jumping right into a job. And at that time, in my early 20s, I worked in the music business, primarily the rock music business of New York City. And for a person in their early 20s, that was the greatest job. I loved it. But then, so I didn't get to my mid-20s, I started looking ahead and saying, well, you know, do I want to carry on with this? Do I want to fight to become a vice president of publicity at a record company or have my own firm? And I said, no. And at the same time, though, I had never left the country. I traveled within the country a little bit. And I said, okay, I want to go. And I spoke to my mother, and she said, you know, she only knew two things. She knew her farming village in Toisan, China, and then a little bit of Hong Kong as she waited for her fake papers essentially to come through and then get on the boat to go to the new world. So she really wanted to see China too. So we went together, and it was a fascinating trip. This is still, you know, this is before China became like the tourism juggernaut it is now. And even a lot of these airplanes and the airports were like, still like the more like a Soviet base, like the small planes and small airports. And it was just a fascinating thing. It really opened me up to really talk about your identity. And it led to all different things too. Suddenly growing up, we did like in the late 20th century, growing up in America, and in my case in New York City, we just assumed we were like the capital of the world. Of course, America, of course, was the greatest thing in the world. And of course, New York City was the greatest part of America. So it was very humbling and empowering to know that, as the old song says, it ain't necessarily so. So going to China and seeing how this and other society that I am part of, it's a strange thing for a lot of immigrant people in America, especially immigrants of people of color. It's a very different world where you think, okay, yes, I am part of this and I'm not part of this. So it was just an eye-opener in every way. And one of the most interesting episodes that's in the book is we got to visit an English language classroom of essentially what would be high school students in the American Western system. And they all started asking me, if there was a war between China and the U.S., who would you fight for? And they were very adamant about it. And then you learn that sometimes humor doesn't always translate. I said, well, I think I'd move to Canada. But that was not a good response for them. But
wow. Now, your first job, I saw you as being very interesting here because you used Alvin from the Island. Tell us about that.
Oh yeah, so my first job was with the Jamaican British record company Island Records. So I so identified with it. They're most known for bringing, of course, the late great Bob Marley and the Wailers to the world. And I guess at that point again, coming out of college, my professional and personal identity was so melded that I felt like I probably called myself Alvin from Ireland the whole time. Just like it became like all one word, Alvin from Ireland. So I really it was that way though too. So that's why I just identified so much with that too. Like I just love that we were in the mainstream, the music business, but somehow a little different. So that's what that became.
Now your brother leaves for L.A. and
yes,
you cared for your mother. How did that change things?
Oh, that really changed things in every way. Because also, in addition to my brother, again, Herman, after nobly stepping up for so many years, you know, he's a musician and a guitar technician, so he moved to LA. And at this point, too, this is now the 1990s, and by that point, of course, my mother was slowing down, and it really made me think about things, though, too. And I guess I made the choice to. It's funny, growing up in the outer boroughs, what they call the other boroughs of New York City besides Manhattan. So in some ways, you know what it's like to grow up in both a small town and in New York City at the same time. And in some ways, though, too, like Again, I found myself at another professional crossroads, like similar to the one that I was experiencing in 1987 when I took the trip to China. And I guess I made the choice to really slow down a little bit on my professional trajectory at that time, and we just spend more time with my mother and just take care of things at the house. Like she could not get around. She still, I don't know how we did all these years. She spoke very little English, and I spoke very little Toisan Cantonese, but we communicated. And I still had to, you know, read all her correspondence that was in English, deal with all her doctors, deal with all doctor's appointments. And it really, and sometimes I think maybe, you know, at that point, things were not really in a great place for me professionally. And I think I got as much out of giving for her, taking care of her, as I did putting into it. And it was just a very healing time, but also it took me out of step with whatever people call the career track you should be on, and made me think about just how the old world, the new world, and looking back, it turned into be a very traditional Chinese household, because a lot of the Chinese households, you don't leave the house, your immediate family, except for marriage, and I was not married yet. So looking back, it led to very traditional things, but that it became a very special period, and I was just honored and glad I could be there for her all those years.
Now, what does number 8 mean?
It always means a good luck, and of course, I guess some of the universal things, it's always an infinity symbol, the 8, and also it's always became a symbol of good luck, prosperity, because again, you've got the infinity and lifelong, and so Chinese always go out of their way to put an 8 somewhere, like so many, I bet, Instagram and Twitter handles and emails, a lot of Chinese will always have to have 8 if they can, and they have even more than 1-8. So it's always been the symbol of good luck, because of longevity, eternity.
Now, you meet Wendy. Tell us about that.
Yes, Wendy, my wife Wendy Wazo, she was a real theater pioneer in downtown New York City. I think people probably know, like, Tribeca is now like one of the trendiest areas in the city, but yet my wife was here when it was still dangerous, and she had a theater company, and so meeting her was very healing. Like I met her just only a few years before my mother passed, but yet it was very vital that we made this great bond, and somehow she really connected with my mother, and that really helped things a lot, that they could have that strong bond. And yet for my mother's 80th birthday, she was very slowing down, but yet I could laugh. I remember a few times she would correct some of my siblings in mid-conversation, saying that, no, she was saying, that's not Alvin's girlfriend, that's his wife. And so I was just very lucky to find that, like, we both had, you'd say, non-traditional paths, and just living the life of the arts. We know about what a different trajectory of a life that is, and just the very unconventional things that you have to do to have this life in the arts. And just, we love the theater. Just our first conversation was just about all different nuances of theater. So I said, we're lucky to have that. And yet, in that time, then when my mother passed, it just changed everything. In some ways, my mother passing also led to the writing of The Last Emperor of Flushing and exploring that. And luckily I had this bond with my now wife, Wendy. So that was that made everything. That was in many ways my first of deeper bonding. And it's just, and what with her, she also was taking care of a single mother in her later years too. And then when Wendy's mother passed, 5 years after my mother passed, at least for me, that really made me say, okay, now we have to get married. I just felt this primarily, viscerally, that I just said, without our parents being physically in this world, we needed that other bond, if you will.
Now, what about your music today?
Oh, yes. I call myself an acoustic punk raconteur, where it came full circle. For a number of years, I was not performing and just writing, but because I started as a performer, again, in punk rock bands, and then, yes, I'm old enough in the pre-internet, pre-MTV generations, we actually had to leave your home, leave your apartment, and go out to clubs and theaters and venues to see and experience music and culture, and then performances were more like performance art, more open-ended. It wasn't just these slick things yes, they were there to promote their records, but it wasn't only to promote their records. It was just, you expected something more from live performance, not just a recreation of the latest hit or the latest popular video. And so I think through that, I got my love of the stage and the power of the stage. And so I'd always written lyrics, but I came back to it in the past few years. Actually, just before the pandemic, I finally picked up the guitar again. And I started playing songs in that piece I was writing about called Here Comes Johnny Yen Again. It features songs, spoken word, and other things too. And I guess it's also spread on by about 10 years ago, 12 years ago. I was in what I call a midlife crisis rock band. We were all these Asian guys. I wanted to call it the Asian American Rock Party, AARP, but a lot of people were not laughing at that name in the band. Said, oh, we can't pretend we're young. But that led me to how much I still love. I'm not a great musician. My brother's a great musician, but I love playing, and I just love the interaction of playing. And that led me to, you know, put that – I felt that if I put it in the context of a storytelling piece where there's a storytelling with some music in it, that works. So I've been writing songs for this piece, Here Comes Johnny Yen Again, and just playing more again. I just love to play. I just love music. So that's where my music is now. But I call myself an acoustic punk raconteur and a performer, because I feel like if you're not quite a trained musician, not quite a trained actor, but you're a writer, that's your lane.
What message would you like the reader to leave after reading your book?
I think that it's really a story of how, again, about how immigration and assimilation, how we all, no matter where we enter this conversation, it impacts us all deeply here in New York City, here in America. And I think it's also looking about how a lot of things we're dealing with now in the reckoning of the past few years, about how I think as a society, we're all really are reconfiguring the parameters of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think there's a lot of the precedence of what one is at least from the Chinese American perspective is there. And it's all about how we grew as a people. And I always think that when I also teach playwriting, I always say in some ways the environment and the locale is another main character. So in some ways, with all the different threads, you know, the Chinese American experience, with the love of music and all these things, at the end of the day, maybe it's a New York City story, like how immigrants thrived and not New York City is really reflected in this book, and how much it's impacted our culture at large, just from my vantage point from being a Chinese American. So I think that's really what it's about, how we came to be here in this city, in this country, in this world, and at this moment where we're still dealing with a lot of the same questions previous generations have dealt with.
What is the next project you're going to be working on?
Yes, it is that Here Comes Johnny Yen Again, and I'm working on a series of what I call portrait plays. The first one was published last year. It's called Three Trees, and it looks at the 20th century sculptor Alberto Giacometti and his obsession with the Japanese philosopher Isakura Yanaihara. And I thought that was very liberating to write about things where I feel like, again, diversity in the arts is a very tricky thing, but where you want authenticity, you want representation, but yet at the same time, I don't want to be told, well, you're a Chinese American. You should only write about Chinese American themes. I want to write about many different things. So this is very liberating to take that. So I'm working on a series of portrait plays. It's primarily historical dramas about artists. The first one's called Three Trees, which is published by No Passport Press, and it's about Giacometti and his obsession with the Japanese philosopher Isakura Yanaihara. The second one is about the famous woman painter Alice Neal, great painter. So it looks at her, the things she's gone through. So those are the main things I'm working on. And what started for the stage about Here Comes Johnny Yen Again, I think that could also work as a book. So I'm trying to work that into a prose format too.
That sounds great. We'll be looking forward to that. And thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for asking about all these wonderful things. And I so admire your podcast. I'm honored to be one of your subjects. Thank you.
Thank you.